Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
Now, the old maxim went something along the lines of some are born great, some achieve greatness, some have greatness thrust upon them. And I think our next guest, who we're delighted to have to feature on the program, is somebody who's also proven to be an inspiration to many, many, many people over the last two decades. He's created a whole range of magic with his autobiographical tales of life and the universe. And his latest, of course, is even more wonderful, if that can be the case, with respect to looking back at what happened on the fateful day of September the 11th, 2001. The latest text is called Running with Russell, and we're delighted to welcome to the Author of the Week feature, truly inspirational, so Michael Higson. How are you, Michael?
I am doing well, thank you.
Well, it's great to connect with your good self, and I suppose it's also true to say that even though in so many ways 9/11 was such a game-changing moment, such a traumatic time, that even in the darkest of times, some good can come out of this. I mean, I'll just actually read, if I may, that opening sort of sequence from the latest text, Running with Russell. Mike Higson sniffed the air of his 78th floor office. The ham and cheese croissant sandwiches he'd just set out for his guests made his stomach growl. His yellow Labrador retriever, Russell, snoozed under his desk with her head on his feet, her favorite pillow. A guide dog, Russell went everywhere with Mike, including to his office at the World Trade Center in New York City. I mean, again, I think, in essence, would you like to just take up the rest of the story from thence without obviously reading the book from that point of view? Because basically, Russell effectively went on to save your life, really.
Well, it went both ways, and I saved her. Of course, that's because she was there. What most people don't really understand about what a guide dog is and what a guide dog does is that a guide dog doesn't lead a blind person, and a guide dog doesn't know where its handler wants to go. And I don't want my dog to know that, because the dog gets into the habit of going one way, and what happens if that way is blocked? So it's really my responsibility to know where to go and how to get there. And how do I do that? Gee, that would be as hard and as long to tell as it would be for you to try to describe the same thing to me. We use different techniques. You use your eyes a lot, which is fine, until you can't. And the reality is, what I have to do, on the other hand, is to, if I'm doing things well, know what to do, especially like in the case of an emergency. So I learned all about how to travel around the World Trade Center, what the emergency and evacuation procedures were, and that included understanding all of my options. But what I do is to give commands to Roselle so that when we need to turn left, I have to tell her to turn left. When we need to turn right, I tell her to turn right. And she walks until she can't anymore, like we get to a corner or a curb outside or whatever the case happens to be. It's a team, and we each have a job to do, and I have to trust her to do her job totally, just as she has to trust me to do my part and give her good, solid directions. So on September 11th, when the planes hit the building and we knew immediately we had to escape, we had some guests in the office, and I had a colleague from our corporate office there, David Frank. David got our guests to the stairs and started them down. And I had said, don't let anyone take the elevator, because part of the emergency procedures, especially if there's fire, and David saw fire in the building, is you don't use the elevators because fire could get into the elevator shafts. And they did. And it did. So David got guests to the stairs. Then he and I went and started down the stairs as well. There's no magic really to going down the stairs. You walk downstairs, you turn, in this case, left 180 degrees, go down some more stairs, and you keep doing that till you get to the bottom. But the other part about that is that we, again, had to work together. And fortunately, I was on the stairs around a number of people who kept their heads and their wits about them, and they did not panic in any kind of an emergency situation. Or when they did, others of us worked to keep people calm and keep people focused, which is what I did at various times going down the stairs. Roselle continued to do her job, which told me that she wasn't sensing anything that caused her concern or fear. And, you know, dogs have a lot higher senses, especially about things like smoke and other things like that, and a lot of senses, emergencies, than we do. But Roselle didn't give me any indication that she was feeling afraid. And I also encouraged her by keeping to tell her as we went down the stairs, good dog, good girl. What a good dog. Keep going. What a good girl. And so she also, from my voice, understood that I was doing okay. So we went down the stairs and we did get outside. Then we were very close to Tower 2 when it collapsed. And that was probably the scariest part for me, because we were like 100 yards away from this building when it fell. And we turned and ran. David Frank, who, as I said, was with me, had already run. It turns out we went the same direction he did, although I didn't really focus on that at the time. But we caught up to each other and continued together to travel. So we escaped Tower 2's collapse. And then the next day after I got home and started processing it, and my wife finally said, you ought to call the people at Guide Dogs for the Blind, where you've gotten all of your dogs, and tell them what happened, because several of them had visited us in the World Trade Center over the past 13 months. So I called, and they put out a news story about it, and that made us very visible in the media, and that kind of started the path of eventually becoming a keynote speaker, traveling literally the world, talking about teamwork, trust, and leadership, telling my story. One of my favorite topics is moving from diversity to inclusion, because when people talk about diversity, they never include persons with disabilities, and we don't let them get away with that if they're going to talk about inclusion. But it's not only about inspiring, but it's about teaching people various things that I can do because I lived them and I learned them, not only as a sales manager, as a company owner, an entrepreneur, but just because I built teams with every guide dog that I used. And it is about building a team. Guide dogs and their handlers are a team. We each have a job to do, and we each need to respect the other person's job, just as it works for a team of human beings. The difference is dogs are more open to trust and don't think we have hidden agendas, which helps a lot.
And Mike, well, obviously, having purchased Running with Roselle, I think it's outstanding. Clearly, in many ways, is it a sequel to Thunder Dog, or is it just a case of, well, it's a companion? You really need to read Thunder Dog and then Running with Roselle, or does it actually matter in which order we actually find out this narrative, which, as I say, it's inspirational. I mean, I think I'd go beyond just saying that you're an American hero, and indeed, likewise, I think Roselle is an American hero. I think you're a global hero.
We got an award from the British Guide Dog Association, so I guess we're known elsewhere. And I've been to New Zealand, I've been to Ireland, to the Irish Guide Dog Schools, I've been to the Netherlands and a number of countries. Still haven't been to Britain, so I hope somebody will invite us to come over and speak one of these days soon. Roselle did win an award from the PDSA. She won the Dickin Award in 2002. It doesn't really matter which order you read them in. They're really companions. The whole idea behind Running with Roselle was we wrote it for children to give them an idea of what it was like as a blind child growing up, a blind youth growing up, and a guide dog growing up. And then we met, and of course, we were thrust into the things that we were thrust into. And so it's a little bit different. It doesn't focus as much on September 11th as Thunder Dog. So they're really different. And what I also find is more adults have been buying Running with Roselle than children. So you can get it from Amazon, and hopefully people will continue to read it. And Thunder Dog is available wherever books are sold. We're working on a third book. And that is one of the things that I talk about. And as I explained a few minutes ago, I really went down the stairs. I wasn't really afraid. But I realized during the pandemic, we've not taught people how to control fear. And the reality is we can control fear. And it's all about really learning and understanding that if you have the right knowledge, you don't need to be afraid of unexpected things that happen to you. And so we are writing a new book. It's called Live Like a Guide Dog. It will be out sometime in July or August of next year. And it will be a little bit different because it's a book that uses the examples of me working with 8 guide dogs and also another dog, Fantasia, who was a breeder from Guide Dogs for the Blind, who became my wife's service dog. Karen was in a wheelchair her entire life. She just passed this past November, which is one of the ending points of the book, but we teach people how to control fear or how they can learn to control fear. And so really excited about that book coming out next year.
I believe you're currently in California. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. Well, I'm in Southern California.
Excellent. We're delighted to again connect both parts of the United States because we've got our regular correspondent from North Carolina with us now, Jessica Burtis. Jessica, I've been listening to Michael's tale there and the text, which I think I'm already going to put up as a highly praised recommendation for one of our Book of the Month series.
Yes.
Jessica, any thoughts for yourself? Any questions for Michael?
I mean, I have so many questions. I have so many, but I think the one that I really want to ask right now is, how did you find the process of writing? And had you written something before, or was this how you decided you wanted to tell your story?
Well, it's interesting. I have written blog articles and other things before, but as the story really goes, in 2002, we went to Florida to attend the American Kennel Club Canine Yukonuba Dog Show, where Roselle was going to be given an award for canine excellence because of what happened on September 11th. And while I was there, I met George Berger, who was at that time the publisher of the AKC, American Kennel Club Gazette. And he said, you ought to write a book. And I hadn't really thought about writing a book and didn't know a lot about writing a book. But I started writing notes. And as I love to tell people, by the time we got to the point of actually writing the book, I had 1.2 megabytes of notes all in text documents. So it was a lot of notes on a disk. And we put it together, and I began working with someone who offered to help, who was a professional writer, Susie Florey. And the reality is it was a very significant collaborative, again, teamwork effort. I love teamwork, and I think that there's a lot to be gained for doing teaming kinds of things. But we began writing it in 2010. Our agent, Chip McGregor, actually was able to arrange a contract with Thomas Nelson Publishing, the largest Christian publisher in the world that's now part of HarperCollins. And so we began writing it. And then in August of 2011, Thunderdog was published. And its first week out, it was on the New York Times bestseller list and was there for 13 weeks. So we're proud of that. And it was number one 1 week. And, you know, what I learned a lot about the process of writing a book and all the things that go into the publishing world. We self-published Running with Roselle through Amazon. Now in the segment that's called Kindle Direct Publishing. The third book that we're coming out with, Live Like a Guide Dog, is actually being published by Tyndale Publishing in Illinois. And that, so we have a contract with them and that will come out next year. So we're excited about all of them, but I hadn't thought about it till George Berger said, you ought to write a book. And he gave me a lot of advice along the way. So I'm very grateful both for his suggesting it and just all the help that he gave over the years.
And as far as starting to write and really tell your story, how did you figure out where to start and what words to use? I think that's one of the harder processes for writing, is kind of deciding how in the world you just want to format your story. So did you have someone there to help you, or did you kind of just do it all on your own?
Kind of both. But the way it started when I began writing and putting down thoughts, remember, something else had already happened in 2001, after the World Trade Center terrorist attacks, Guide Dogs for the Blind put out a news article, and I started getting lots of requests for interviews by the press, but also a number of requests to come and speak to companies and organizations and schools to tell my story and to talk about lessons that we should learn from September 11th and other things that happen in our lives. And so I had done a significant amount of speaking even before beginning to write the book, but that helped me coalesce a lot of the thoughts. And it was my thought originally that I think the purpose of the book needed to not only be to tell the World Trade Center story and why I survived, but really a lot of what it's like to be a person who is blind, because people have totally the wrong idea about blindness. The biggest problem with people and blindness is that everyone thinks they're an expert and they've never tried it. And the reality is blindness isn't the problem. It's our poor attitudes and misconceptions and lack of education. The fact is you guys have as much a disability in a way as I do. Your disability is that you can see. Why is that a disability? Just imagine being in a room and suddenly the lights go out because there's a power failure. What's the first thing you do? You go hunt for a flashlight or a smartphone or some sort of light source. So Thomas Edison invented the electric light bulb and gave you guys light on demand pretty much all the time until you don't have it. And then you are stuck. The reality is that that is just as much a disability as blindness is, except mostly you get to cover it up because light on demand is pretty common. So I learn different kinds of things to be able to accomplish the same tasks, and I don't need to use that light. So I love to tell the story that I was in a hotel in March of this year when the lights went out in the hotel and people started screaming, and it turns out that there was a power failure in and around the hotel. People didn't know what to do, didn't bother me a bit. But the fact of the matter is I wanted to not only write a book to tell the story, but to teach people about blindness. So the format that I thought would make the most sense was to start each chapter with something that was happening in the World Trade Center that day to me as we went down the stairs and as everything occurred, go back in my life and transition back in each chapter to lessons that I learned that helped me deal with whatever was going on at that particular point in the chapter. And then at the end of the chapter, come back and finish up talking about any particular situation in the World Trade Center. So the book does recount my story of that day, going down, getting out, escaping from Tower 2's collapse, and so on. But along the way, we talk about my faith, my lessons that I learned, that I try to impart to other people to say, blindness isn't the problem. You don't need to fear it. And it makes a difference, and it's helping. We've got a long way to go because people really still are so ingrained in their views that if you're blind, you can't do stuff. And if you're blind, your dog leads you around, which is such a total misconception.
Is there something that you would like to see those, or just everyone really, do to advocate for individuals with disabilities, and especially those with blindness or vision impairment?
No, not vision impairment. Reason being, if you talk to a deaf person and you say they're hearing impaired, they're liable to deck you on the spot because they recognize that you shouldn't be comparing how much a person hears or doesn't hear by calling them hearing impaired. And unfortunately, with blind people, we haven't really learned that as much yet. So it's blind or low vision, and that's fine. No criticism, just pointing that out.
No, it's okay. I'm learning. Thank you.
But the biggest thing I really think that people need to do is to include us in the conversation. Look, we talk about diversity, right? But when you talk about diversity, it's usually an issue of sexual orientation, gender, race, and so on. And disabilities aren't included. Disabilities are feared so much still. If you watch, say, a person in a wheelchair and a child with their parent come along, the child might be curious about the wheelchair, or a blind person with a dog and the child is curious about the dog. Oh, don't go pet that dog. That dog might bite. Or don't go talk to that person in that wheelchair. They might not like it. Children are taught by their parents to fear and avoid disabilities. And I've seen it in so many ways. The unemployment rate among employable blind people around the world is in the 60 to 70% range. And it's not because we can't work. It's people think we can't work because they've never been taught different. So if there's one thing I'd like to see changed, it is we need to be included in the conversation and we need to be given the same opportunities as other people. We may not accomplish tasks using exactly the same tools. I don't use a computer monitor. I use a piece of software called a screen reader that gives me access to the data on a screen that you see. Doesn't do pictures very well, but there are other ways to address that. But the bottom line is there are alternatives that both do the same thing, and they should be just as welcoming. The cost of doing business for any company ought to include making reasonable accommodations for persons with disabilities. And we should be included in the conversation. There's never anything wrong with asking us questions, but people are afraid to.
Just sitting, listening to you, Michael, again, I'm getting a sense that clearly destiny, fate, providence, whatever your one's belief, clearly needed you to actually survive to share your message post 9/11. But if I could return to the time when I think, Jessica, you weren't even born 9/11, were you? Were you an infant at the time?
I was just barely, I was 2 and my brother was 4 days old.
Yeah.
So I don't remember it.
Yeah.
So precisely, but I mean, something which clearly had a seismic impact on the world and so on. Do you think that lessons are or have been learned? I mean, we've heard again the horrendous notion that we recently had Israel's 9/11. Mm. We've got the horrendous scenario there. We had the war on terror, which again seems to make no sense whatsoever. I mean, as a citizen of the planet, I mean, we've talked about obviously the importance of inclusivity and so on. But do you sometimes shrug your shoulders and think, what the heck are our leaders talking about, basically? Why can they not realize that actually this constant battle? And to be fair, you were successful before 9/11. As we said, you were hosting a business meeting. Things were coordinated from that point of view. Do you feel as though actually we aren't learning, or is it just a case of we're learning, but it's taking us an awful long time as a human race?
Right after September 11th, I remember in this country, and I think around the world to a large degree, there was so much unity. People were united. They understood that this was a terrorist attack. And for the most part, it wasn't a religious attack, a religious war. It was a bunch of thugs who wanted to try to impose their will on everyone. But we have allowed all of that to slip away. And so as you talk about our leaders and shrugging your shoulder, I got to wonder where the leadership is. They're not learning lessons from it. We're not saying this is unacceptable. As you said, what's going on in Israel now and in Gaza is a significant problem. And it's a problem on so many levels. But the bottom line is that Hamas attacked Israel. And it's as much as I grieve for every Palestinian and Jewish person who was killed and is being killed, the bottom line is, when do we draw the line and say we're not going to accept terrorism anymore? And when are we going to take the lead to really deal with that issue? We being all of us, and not be powerless and stand up for doing things to help better the world. So I love to think that I get to do that by talking about my experiences and talking about ethics, talking about how we can deal with fear. And I know a lot of what's going on with a lot of people today is they're afraid. And we've got to help people understand they don't need to be. And there comes a time when you have to stand up and literally take a stand to do what we have all been taught is supposed to be right.
Roselle, obviously she's in canine heaven now. What do you think she'd make of the whole sort of process that both of you surviving 9/11 and working as a team? What do you think if we could anthropomorphize for a time? What would her thoughts be?
In 2016, we were in Ohio speaking for a library, and they had reserved an amphitheater. So I think there were like 700 seats in the amphitheater. It was in October of 2016. And about a week before the event, Donald Trump suddenly announced that he was going to come to the same town. And so when we got there and all of the people who said they were going to come to our event did come, but we decided that it would be kind of fun to say, look, Trump tried to steal our audience and couldn't do it. But we're here to announce that Roselle is running for president because she has a nose to the ground kind of politics that nobody else has. Roselle would focus. If she knew she had a job to do, she would do it. And Roselle would take a stand. And she did in all the things that she did. And one of the most important things about Roselle was that she really did focus very well on doing her job. And she didn't let outside things distract her. She was afraid of thunderstorms for a lot of the time that we lived in New Jersey, but sometimes we had to be outside or even inside some places where she was guiding. And I know that it bothered her a little bit that the thunder was happening, but she could still focus and guide even in a thunderstorm. Now, if she were home and she was not guiding, she would shake and shiver and so on, but with the harness on, she focused. And I can't ask for anything more than that from her or anyone else on a team to focus and do their job and give as much feedback and input as they can to whatever is going on.
Jessica is now going to put to you the question that we always refer to as the North Carolina nutrition question. I'd be fascinated by the response to this, Michael. Jessica, over to you.
Yeah, I like sausage biscuits, by the way. Go ahead.
Oh, an excellent choice. This is also
that's a third one. That's a third aspect. You've never talked about sausage biscuits before, Jessica.
Well, I've been to conventions in North Carolina and had sausage biscuits, so of course.
Well, then you've probably also had this. So curious, have you ever tried, and if you have, do you like sweet tea and also even maybe boiled peanuts?
I've not had boiled peanuts. I'm not a great fan of sweet tea. I like hot tea. I like a good, vibrant British tea. Alex, I like PG Tips tea and order it from Amazon all the time. So I've never been as great a fan of sweet tea just because I really don't like things that are too sweet. I've tried it. And if that's all there were available, I would drink it. But I'm much more a fan of hot, not quite so sweet tea.
It's okay. I will forgive that because I also agree that PG Tips tea is excellent. So we have a middle ground here. We can agree.
I don't think, I'm trying to remember, I don't think I've had boiled peanuts, but I'm not going to say I haven't. I may have, but I don't recall right off.
You'll have to try some again, see if you remember having
them.
Well,
we've got to find me a speaking engagement in North Carolina so I can come and get some. So I'm going to leave that to you.
I'm going to work hard and I'll give you some boiled peanuts.
Perfect.
Clearly, as we head through to, well, nearly the end of 2023, now approaching 2024, time continues its remorseless march for the whole thing. You said, obviously, exciting news that we'll probably have a third book in the series coming through sometime next year. What about movie rights? I mean, I would have thought surely Hollywood would be banging down the door to actually get this story and narrative actually told and put on the big screen.
There are some people working on it, but of course, there have been a lot of challenges with the pandemic and everything else. I would have thought that it would have happened before now, but you know, people have their priorities. But we do have some wonderful people who are working on negotiating a contract, and I think we're getting pretty close.
Well, fingers crossed for that. Hopefully, it's,
yes, absolutely. Deserves,
it's a story that deserves to have a wide dissemination, and certainly that inspirational side of things is something we're very much in need of. Jessica, back to yourself. Any final thoughts?
I have an important question. I saw that you're a Harry Potter fan. I am also a massive fan, so I have to know, if you have to pick a favorite, what would be your favorite Harry Potter book and character?
Oh gosh. I must say, if I really have to pick a favorite character, you know, I like Harry Potter as a character, but I'm attracted to Dumbledore just because he's a very thoughtful person, and I think he really thinks a lot about things. As far as my favorite book, it would probably be Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, because I also like Sirius Black, and I think that he added a lot, and I'm sorry that we lost him so early. There's now a new series out. It's a James Potter. It's Harry's son. I'd love to see somehow Sirius Black come back, but we'll see.
It was, that was a tough part of the series, losing Sirius. Mm-hmm. He, I think, was my favorite character. Do you know what house you would be in at Hogwarts?
What house I would be in?
Yes.
Probably Gryffindor. I would personality wise not really like to be in Slytherin. I could probably cope with the other houses, but I would probably think that because I do like to stand up and take positions, that I would probably have been in Gryffindor. Probably.
Yeah. I don't think anybody but really wants to be in
Slytherin.
I
would communicate with the Sorting Hat about that.
Yes.
And I see, again, back to nutrition, you're quite a fan of nachos with cheese only. Is that a specific? Is it a case of anybody?
I just like cheese and chips. I like melted cheese and chips, and I don't like to put a lot of other stuff on them, partly because it's messy and just partly it's easier to cook.
Yeah.
So I have bags of corn chips and I have shredded cheese, so I do pretty well with it.
Excellent. Let's talk a little bit about Africa, of course, who I gather hopefully is still with you. I'm not sure whether his
she is not.
She's not. All right.
She retired in 2018 and Alamo took her place. Alamo is my first black lab. He's a male. But anyway, talking about Africa, she worked from late 2008 and then in 2018 retired and passed 2 years later. She went to live with her puppy raisers because we had Fantasia, who was her mother, and then Alamo, who came along. And we figured that three dogs was a little bit too much, especially if I were traveling, two of them being home with Karen, she wouldn't really be able to take care of two dogs. So Africa went to live with her puppy raisers.
So Alamo, is that because you remember the Alamo or for no other reason that you like Davy Crockett?
Actually, I didn't name him. Every guide dog litter, every litter of puppies that guide dogs produces is assigned a letter of the alphabet. And it happens to be that the litter that he was born into was an A litter. It was assigned A as letter of the alphabet. And they have a big book where they choose names out of the book. They don't use a name twice that is at the same time. So, for example, when Roselle was a guide dog, there was no other guide dog named Roselle. Now, in Roselle's case, they retired Roselle. So Roselle's name will not be used anymore at Guide Dogs for the Blind. But like Africa and other guide dogs I've had, when they retire, then the name goes back into the sequence. But Alamo was the name, I guess, that came out of the book. So it happens to be, I'm sure that when it was originally suggested in part, it was Remember the Alamo, but I didn't name him and chose not to change the name. It's a great name. He likes it.
And that's the most important thing, really.
Yeah.
Let's progress to almost the end of this particular piece. Do you have any particular musical favorites that inspire you at all? Or is it a case of, whatever happens to suit the mood at the time?
I'm a big fan of old radio shows from the 30s, 40s, 50s, and into the 60s and so on. And I also like big band music a great deal. I'm a big Benny Goodman fan, especially. But I like big band music. I like rock, not so much heavy metal or some of the stuff today, although other people do, and that's great. I think that there are so many forms of music and so many art forms that come under the category that it gives everyone the opportunity to pick something. I also do like classical music. I'm a great fan of the Boston Pops as well, the orchestra. I've heard the Pops in concert in Boston. I've not heard the Boston Symphony Orchestra, but I have heard the Pops. So I like a variety of different kinds of music. It's nice to have stuff in the background.
Okay, so choice between Benny Goodman, Boston Pops, and let's say the Beatles' latest single and possibly last single, recently released, Now and Then. What would you do? What would you go for?
Oh, I got to still stick with Benny Goodman. I thought that the last Beatles song, it was very slow. It seemed like it was a little bit sad to me, but I haven't really listened to all the words in great detail. But I'm glad that they were able to produce it. I think that is so cool, even though it came out well, after John Lennon passed and George. But by the same token, I'm glad that it's there and I like it. But I'm still, if it's going to come down to it, I'll still take Benny Goodman.
We'll go with some Benny Goodman then in a few moments' time. But before then, a couple of final questions. After, of course, a reminder that you can, of course, access both Thunderdog, The True Story of a Blind Man, His Guide Dog, and The Triumph of Trust at Ground Zero, and of course what we've been talking around today, which of course is Running with Roselle. They're both available on all platforms, good bookstores, and so on and so forth. But we do have two final questions for you, and Jessica, would you like to ask the first, please?
I would love to. Michael, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us today?
Oh, I have. I very much enjoyed it. I really appreciate you all having us on, and you've asked some great questions. So absolutely, this has been fun.
And the next critical question, of course, is will you be able to return? Can we invite you back again? Will you come back and share us some more inspirational talks of your time as a 9/11 survivor and as a blind, not visually impaired individual? I'm glad you corrected us on that one, because like Jessica, yeah, I was very tempted to actually use the VI line.
Any old time you'd like. I would be happy to. It would be fun. And of course, turning it around, I hope that if you all can, I'd love it if you'd find us some speaking opportunities to come and visit. Alamo would love to go to England. We were in Tel Aviv in August. And again, I'd love to take Alamo on some more international trips. And also, we need to come to North Carolina and have some more sausage, yes, biscuits and other things. So I hope that we can find some opportunities to do that.
Well, maybe Oliver Cromwell would have invested in air fryers. Then again, of course, he banned Christmas, which probably solved the problem when he came round to thinking how he could afford Christmas. Recent research suggests that this Christmas, 2023, could be one of the most frugal on record, as people are actually struggling to cope with the cost of living and a whole range of other factors as well. So we've decided to actually bring in a true heroine to save our Christmas and save a whole range of ways in the run-up to the next month and a half or so. We're delighted to welcome consumer champion extraordinaire Anna Richardson. How are you, Anna?
Oh, Alex, I'm just still reeling from the fact that Oliver Cromwell banned Christmas.
Yeah, I know. A bit of a shocker, but still. You know, let's put the work of the previous centuries to one side and consider the 21st century, which is, I think, what we need to do. I mean, were you surprised by these findings that more and more people are finding that they're having to cope with a budget of, say, £300 and that's it, really, or they won't have any trees or anything?
No, not at all. I mean, there are some shocking statistics within this, which I'll come to in a second. But if you think about it, the cost of living is having a huge impact on all of us. I include myself within that. So I think that we are all in the same boat. There's some interesting stats that have come out of the research that Top Cashback have done, including the fact that 50% of Brits are saying that they're going to be reducing their budget for Christmas by about 25% this year. To keep costs down, people are talking about not having any Christmas lights. 1 in 10 people won't even have a tree, which I think is incredibly sad. But then the most shocking stat of all that's come out of this research is that 25% of people in the UK will have less than £300 this Christmas to spend on everything. So that's including presents, the tree, decorations, food, travel, you name it. I mean, that took me by surprise. £300 is all some families are going to have is extraordinary.
Yeah, indeed so. However, let's just move on to some of those top tips, and there are indeed six of them that you suggest could actually help, starting off with, of course, planning ahead and actually making use of the upcoming Black Friday and Cyber Monday events.
Yeah, I mean, I do have quite a few top tips, but the three main ones really are, and a lot of people ignore this, but make use of the sales. If you're trying to make money or save money this year, and, you know, we need to, make use of the sales. So look out for Black Friday, check out Cyber Monday, look out for all the flash sales that you'll see a lot of the high street shops will be running. It's a great way of getting your Christmas essentials at a knockdown price this year. The other thing that I tend to do is when the Boxing Day sales come along, buy up all of those Christmas decorations that are going for a song because they can be used for next year. So I did that last year. I've bought all this year's decorations in last year's Boxing Day sales. So it's a really good tip. Big, big, big money-saving hack here. Make use of discount codes and cashback. If you don't already know about it, then sign up to a site like Top Cashback and do all of your shopping through one site. Basically, it's a platform with access to thousands of brands, shops that you'd be using every day anyway. When you buy through that single platform and access those shops and shop through them, you get money back. You can make up to £350 a year. I've signed up. I shop all my brands through Top Cashback. It's a really good hack. So then finally, the other big hack that I would suggest, host your own market. So if you are short of money this year, whether you want to get rid of clothes, furniture, whether you've made your own Christmas crafting things, perhaps you've baked some cookies, whatever it is, think about hosting your own community market. I do it about 3 or 4 times a year. Last one I did, I managed to sell lots of clothes that I've either worn on TV or, you know, worn around the summer and now want to get rid of. I made nearly £1,000. So think about hosting your own market. If that feels like too much for you, even just sort of taking a stall, then think about selling through Vinted or Facebook Marketplace. There's money to be made by getting rid of your old stuff.
Once again, eminently wonderful range of tips there. But I think also one of the key things that came out from your suggestions to me, Anna, was the notion that actually you need to concentrate on the essentials. I mean, there'll be people listening to this who say, Christmas, I don't do Christmas, I do the holiday season, or I don't do the holiday season, or whatever you're actually working through. It's very much a case of focusing on what one's individual priorities happen to be, I suppose. And maybe even something you've suggested, possibly working with the neighbours as well.
Absolutely. I mean, you're right to say Christmas doesn't have to be about consumerism. It doesn't have to be about spending inordinate amounts of money. If you think about the message of Christmas, really, it's about hope and love. It's about connection. So if you're just not feeling it, if Christmas isn't for you, again, one thing that I do pretty much every other year is I volunteer on Christmas Day. So last year I did it through Age UK. It is a fantastic way of getting out of the house on Christmas Day and actually going and working for people who are less fortunate than you. It really reminds you of the Christmas spirit, actually, when you're talking to perhaps older people who are really lonely. And the fact that you are making their Christmas dinner, you're entertaining them, it gives you a huge boost of dopamine, makes you feel great about yourself. And I think just reminds you of really what Christmas is about.
And also, of course, if you're out and about, you don't have to have the Christmas tree lights on. So that's another saving as well.
It's another boon. It's another boost there for sure. I mean, yeah, you're right. You're out for the entire day. You don't have any of the lights on and you're helping other people. And you get your Christmas dinner thrown in. It's brilliant.
Definitely a win-win situation. Anna, where can people find out some more details about your tremendous tips and indeed ways to connect?
If you want the tips and if you want the ways to connect, then just head over to topcashback.co.uk. There's loads of information on there.
Anna Richardson, broadcaster extraordinaire and consumer champion. You may have just saved Christmas, I think, Anna. So well done on that routine. Huge thanks and happy holidays.
Thank you, Alex, and happy Christmas to you.
Now, it's fair to say that the words "bridging the gap to healthier living, a multi-market exploration of fruit and vegetable consumption, trends and behaviours" may not actually trip off the tongue in terms of, yes, I've got to download that report immediately. But it does have a lot of resonance in terms of our eating habits. And apparently it seems that despite the notion of five a day, less than a quarter of us are actually consuming those five a day every day. Now, to talk us through some of the high spots of this report, comprised by, of course, Juice Plus, we're delighted to welcome gastrophysicist at the University of Oxford. That's Professor Charles Spence. How are you, Charles?
Hi there, very well, thank you.
Excellent. So were you surprised by this, or is it a case of, well, we know that effectively three quarters of British folk are now eating less fruit and vegetables than perhaps they should be?
So the report surveyed about 32,000 people in total, 5,000 in the UK, across Europe and the US primarily. And some of the findings, I guess, might be as one expected, but there are also certainly surprises, even for me, who spent a lot of time thinking about fruit and veg consumption. I guess the depressing side of things, maybe, at the outset, is just that only one in four Brits think they're eating the five a day. This is the five a day that the World Health Organization recommends we should all be consuming as a minimum. And that part of the reason for this failing to meet the guidelines is that one in two Brits admit that when you press them, they're not really quite sure what a portion is anyway. Is that a handful or something else? And all the kind of the confusion that sometimes emerges when we see different experts and authorities and guidelines coming out. Is it five a day? Is it 10 a day? I don't know quite who I should believe. And that sort of uncertainty about the advice and uncertainty about what a portion is kind of contributing, along with a few other factors, to our less than ideal fruit and veg consumption, shall we say.
One of the clear elements that comes across time and time again when we start talking about healthy diets is, well, that's all well and good if I've actually got a decent salary, but if I can't actually afford basic heating costs, I've got issues with respect to food as well. Is that something which also impacts the findings?
Absolutely. And I think that the cost of living crisis is very present on a daily basis for many of us. And that is borne out by the report, both in terms of if we can access fresh fruit and veg, which fruit and veg do we go for? And also an emerging trend to kind of also return, if you will, to sort of canned fruit and veg that may be more easily available, maybe a little cheaper. And crucially for many of the respondents, they worry about the fact that a third of the food they throw away is food waste. That's all coming from the fresh fruit and veg. And hence, by shifting a little more towards the canned variety, that hopefully helps them to reduce some of the food waste and ensure that they're consuming more of the good stuff and not throwing it in the bin instead. And in terms of the fresh produce, then I just think back a couple of years to kind of the way that blueberries seemed to take over the supermarkets. Everyone was on a blueberry thing. They had a magical health properties. But what comes out of the report released today is that nowadays blueberries are nowhere on the list of England or Europe's most preferred fruits. Instead, it is the banana. And I think that shift from the soft fruits like the blueberries may be related to price, that they can tend to be a little more expensive to purchase than some of the other fruits, perhaps like bananas. And maybe we're seeing the same thing also in the vegetable category, that broccoli, which for many people, you know, some people at least find it unpleasantly bitter tasting. And yet that is the number one vegetable mentioned in a number of the European countries, including the UK. And one wonders how much is the cost of living crisis playing into that.
You mentioned other European countries. Of course, for a long time, the Mediterranean diet has been deemed to be the absolute gold standard of healthy eating and so on. Is that still the case? And indeed, how do countries like Italy and the Mediterranean countries compare? Because it doesn't look as though France or Germany are doing as well as perhaps they originally had hoped.
Yeah, so I am not a nutritionist myself. And I've got my latest book. I'm just reading it at the moment, which is saying, well, I haven't got to the end of the Mediterranean diet chapter, but I fear it's saying it's not quite all it's cracked up to be, that there are maybe other factors involved than the ones that are sometimes promoted. Certainly, I think, you know, when we are in Mediterranean, if we're on our holidays, then we may find ourselves having more fruit and veg than we do necessarily at home. And maybe they just seem to taste better. They're more flavoursome, more aromatic. And then I wonder is whether that's really part of not so much the Mediterranean diet, but the Provençal rosé paradox, this kind of phenomenon whereby, you know, everything that we taste when we're on a holiday in the Mediterranean seems to taste better. The wine tastes better. The cheese tastes better. The fruit and veg taste better.
Even the garlic, perhaps.
Even the garlic. So much so that, you know, we're tempted very often to bring some of that wine or cheese or food or sausages back home. And when we try it at home, it just never tastes the same. Mm. It kind of is the same wine, but something is lost. And I think that sort of speaks to the impact of mood on food perception and food choice, that when we're on holiday, we're more likely to be relaxed, hopefully more likely to be in a good mood if we're not work at stressed. And that mood can then impact our food choices and our enjoyment of that which we choose. So maybe it's just that bit easier in the Mediterranean to go for the fruit and veg than it is in some other countries.
Juiceplus.co.uk is, of course, the location to go to actually download the full report. As a gastrophysicist, which is a concept I've never come across, I mean, does that mean you actually deal with the physics of peristalsis and the borborygmy side of things in terms of how we digest our foods, or am I completely off base?
So it's kind of a combination of gastronomy, meaning sort of nice food, rather than the foods that are often studied by food scientists for the food companies. I'm interested in nice food, the stuff that maybe chefs you see on TV make. And then the physics comes from psychophysics, which is kind of a branch of psychology where you try and understand what really drives people's choices, their perception and their behavior, and thinking about things in the case of, say, fruit and veg, how by increasing the color variety in a meal, by getting more fruits, colored fruits and veg on the plate, then that will both look more visually appealing, which can encourage people to eat more. If things look beautiful, then you'll eat more, but also probably means that you get a better nutrient balance if you've got various colored fruit and veg that you're consuming. As well as thinking a lot about, as a gastrophysicist, I think about the importance of sound, you know, because sound's not really something we think about when we think about taste or flavor. And yet so many of the snack foods that we gravitate towards, that we look forward to, are the biscuits, are the crisps, are the nuts. And they all have one thing in common. They all make noise. They're all crunchy, crispy. And so with that insight that most of our snacking behavior is driven by the search for noisy food, then I kind of take that into the realm of fruit and veg and think about, you know, the benefits of celery, of carrots, of apples that naturally have the crunch that so many of us crave. And how shifting to kind of, you know, a more natural crunch for a snack might be one of the easy ways into making sure that we do get the five a day that the World Health Authority is advising that we do.
Although I gather that your well-known fast food manufacturer of crisps has actually introduced the world's first silent crisp to actually deal with the irritation online of crunching through various other bits and pieces. So who knows where we could be heading with respect to that one. Charles, as we mentioned, folks can go to juiceplus.co.uk for the full report. Where can they actually follow your own research?
So I think a lot of it's available over the internet. Gastrophysics, the New Science of Eating, is my book from 2017 that has a lot of these ideas and insights around the senses and eating and how to nudge people to eat more healthily and to get more enjoyment out of food. Available in all good bookstores, if they still exist, and online and you know where.
And do you actually have a favourite fruit or vegetable item yourself? I mean, you talked about, obviously, broccoli and some of the other aspects. Is there one which you think, yes, fundamentally, I need to have my green beans, otherwise I'm a hectoliter?
For me, it's actually, and I've written about this recently, I like the sour stuff, really. So I like the gooseberries. I love the rhubarb. When I go to Colombia, where my wife is from, then very often I'll have the lulo, which is like a very acidic fruit we don't see in this country. And it's that kind of the acidic end of the spectrum that I really like. I don't like the ones that are overly sweet. It's just a shame that, I'm from Leeds, so I'm not far from the rhubarb triangle. Maybe it's my regional route speaking, but I really do find more enjoyment in the acidic end of the fruit spectrum.
And fundamentally, surely rhubarb and custard has to be a kind of classic delicacy of the North that needs to be spread further. Professor Charles Spence, gastrophysicist extraordinaire from the University of Oxford, huge thanks, and keep on keeping on.
Thank you.